Welcome to Latte with a Lawyer, a podcast dedicated to bringing you the stories of some of America's most successful lawyers, figuring out what makes them tick, how they creatively solve problems, and how others aspiring to be them can follow in their footsteps.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Latte with a Lawyer. I'm your host, Jonathan Brickman, and this morning we have with us Nicole Kobus. And Nicole, I got to read the name. Lindaberry, McCormick, Estabrook, and Cooper.
You got them all.
Excellent. Good. We don't want to leave anybody out there.
Absolutely not. Jonathan, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Absolutely. Good to have you. So latte with a lawyer. First question, what's your morning beverage of choice to get started?
I'm an iced coffee girl, splash a half and half, maybe a little vanilla flavoring in there, but iced coffee, even in the freezing cold New Jersey winter months.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, everybody asks you that nowadays. You want it hot or cold? To me, coffee is always supposed to be hot, but
the colder the better. I'm one of those. Any beverage, extra ice in it, nothing lukewarm, nothing room temperature. I like the ice.
All right. Good. Well, that's probably to cool down your clients, right? So as we pivot to your practice, you practice family law, right?
I do. I've been doing it for over a decade. That is, I've expanded my practice there. It also includes guardianship work, but for the primary purpose, I'm a family law attorney.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's go more detail about what you do day to day and, you know, sort of just give me a sense of what your practice is.
So the primary focus of my practice is divorces and non-dissolution matters. Non-dissolution matters meaning that a couple has had a child, but they never got married, but a lot of their issues related to their relationship end up being very similar to divorce. I do a lot of mediations. I am a certified family law mediator. I also do parent coordination work. I also do collaborative divorce work. I'm appointed frequently as a guardian ad litem for children in high conflict divorce cases and other family law matters. But so really anything that touches prenuptial agreements, those are always the nice and happy ones when people are getting ready to take on the next chapter of their lives. So anything related to families, I end up handling.
Okay. And I've had a bunch of family lawyers on the show here. Prenup is definitely around the country. Everybody's getting a prenup.
It is. This is where I start cooking up the season for prenups. I typically tell clients, you want to leave somewhere between 3 to 6 months, ideally, at least for a prenuptial agreement. They're much more complex than people end up thinking they are. Yeah. And the last thing you want to be is getting your dress altered at the last minute and signing your prenup on the same day. So we try to get them done as quickly as possible. And, you know, you put in an envelope, you put in a drawer, and you hope you never have to see it ever again. But a lot of people tend to wait to the last minute. So it ends up being, you know, a bit of a scramble to get things done at the end of the day. But better discuss these matters during happy times than discuss them when you're fighting, if God forbid you end up needing to get a divorce.
I ask this question all the time, but it has to be an awkward conversation, right?
It is. Listen, I would imagine it's not probably the best conversation. It's not like choosing where you want to go to dinner on a Friday night.
Yeah.
But, and unfortunately, a lot of times, the prenuptial agreement, both people are not necessarily motivated in the same way. There's typically someone who either comes in with a higher paying job, more retirement assets, or family money
right.
that they're going to get, you know, one day. There's a much easier conversation when you have two people from well-off families who both are going to get money. And they're like, we need to each protect our own. That's usually the rare kind. It's usually an unbalance going into a prenuptial agreement. But with that being said, though, I typically try to steer my clients just to make sure the prenuptial agreement is fair. Doesn't mean that necessarily you're going to leave your spouse with zero, because that might not be fair at the end of the day, but also having a conversation. If I'm the one that's representing the not moneyed spouse or the person who maybe not is as inclined to get a prenuptial agreement, why this is important and what benefits them at the end of the day too. It's definitely becoming a more popular thing to do. I was very busy with prenuptial agreements leading up to the fall wedding season. Mm. And definitely more prenuptial agreements are for the average consumer now. I think that as people are getting married, a lot of people are getting married later in life. So they do have assets already that have been accumulated on their own, whether it's property or retirement assets or investment assets.
Yeah.
So I do think it's becoming more popular, and hopefully the stigma is starting to be lifted, that it's not necessarily just for the rich and famous, and that it's for average citizens also that just want to protect what is theirs.
Yeah. No, I see that. And does that override, in other words, if you don't have a prenup, then the state decides how things are going to be divided. So the prenup, does that supersede?
It does. It does. It does. So it's the way that you could have, for example, spousal support waived. It's the way where you could say, in New Jersey, at least, when you come into a marriage with assets, they're typically exempt from equitable distribution. But then things happen during a marriage. For example, if you don't have a prenup and you use money from a premarital, let's say, investment account to purchase the down payment for the down payment on the marital home without a prenup, likelihood that money is gone and that just goes back into the marital pot. In a prenup, you could say something, for example, that if the wife is to use money from a premarital asset to purchase the marital home, upon the sale of that house, the wife will get her initial investment back before any other money gets split between the two of them. So things like that are very common to do in a prenuptial agreement.
Okay, very good. Excellent. So let's talk about how did you get there? Like, how did you become a lawyer? How'd you make that decision? How'd you get started?
So it's funny. So law was a second career for me. I went to college in Washington, D.C., and I was a public relations and marketing major.
What school did you go to?
I went to American.
Okay.
Yeah. I went to American and I had a job offer in Washington, D.C. to stay there. And I had a boyfriend, now husband, in New Jersey. And so I left Washington, D.C. after graduation and I started working in the fashion industry, doing public relations and marketing for a large fashion brand. Loved it. It was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. Met a ton of cool people, got to travel, went to a bunch of amazing events. And I just realized that long term, I wanted to help people. And I really wanted to do something in client service. Law was always something in the back of my head in college. But I think that I really needed those few years of working in corporate America to realize that was actually what I wanted to do and be grounded enough to do it. So then I went back to law school. I went to Rutgers in Newark, New Jersey. And then from there, right after law school, I clerked for the presiding judge of the family division in Union County, Judge Dupuy, who is now actually a retired judge and works at my firm. And from there, I was recruited to Linda Berry, and I have been there ever since. So I wanted to do family law. It was definitely something I was interested in during law school. And fortunately for me, the pieces all fell into place. And, you know, 10 plus years later, still at the same firm. Now I'm a partner there, and I haven't looked back.
Oh, good. Wait, and you knew you wanted to do family law?
I wanted the people interaction. I'm very much a people person. I like having the client interaction. So doing something that was necessarily corporate focused, probably I didn't think was going to be a good fit for me.
Yeah.
And during law school, I had interned for two judges, one who did a family calendar and the other who did a complex civil calendar. And I loved the family work. And I actually stayed on with him for another year and a half after my first year with him. As a side note, he ended up being the judge who married my husband and I. We're still very much in touch. And I just found that work much more gratifying to me than the large complex civil cases, which were very interesting. But at the end of the day, I knew I wanted to be client facing pretty early on in my career. And so family law seemed to be the best fit. And then after my clerkship, having spent a year doing all family law work, it's something that I really enjoyed.
Got it. What's your favorite part of the practice?
My favorite part of the practice is settling a case. And that is where I have focused my practice. And especially with COVID and the backlogs in the court system, mediations and settlements are more important now than they ever were before. But I like the challenge of a problem and that people come for settlements, not necessarily because they want the cookie cutter standard. Okay, we're going to do 50-50 here. This is the child support. This is the alimony. This is the parenting time, but more of a complicated problem that you need to get creative, and not every family fits into the same cookie cutter mold. And the gratification of we finally get a settlement that everyone is okay with, that to me is the best part of it.
So is there a knack to arrive at a non-cookie cutter settlement? I mean, what's the skill set to do that?
I think being a listener, you know, it's something that I think everyone could probably improve on, and really listening to what is important to your client, not necessarily hearing what they're saying, but getting deeper into what is driving the reasons for certain things and the reasons for positions that they're taking. I think also a huge part of the mediation and settlement process is managing expectations. a settlement does not mean you win. A settlement does not mean you lose. So there has to be give and take, and really making a client understand what are the top three or five things that you really need to get from this, and what can you let go? And also, what can they anticipate that their spouse, due to be former spouse, is not going to want to let go, and to see where you could find the balance between those.
What are the stats these days? I know it's pretty high. Unfortunately, most people are going to end up in your office.
The stats are very high. I think COVID especially made the stats even higher.
Okay.
And now people are in a tricky situation. You know, for a while during COVID, we had people being stuck, literally. Like, rental offices were closed for apartments. There was no inventory for houses. So you were under the same roof with, you know, your spouse you didn't want to be. Now that, you know, the housing market is booming here, people are getting absurd prices for their houses. It's certainly having people come into maybe a little extra money that they didn't think that they were going to have. And I think also it's made typically the younger generation realize that, you know, mortality is a thing and you only get to live once. And if you're not happy, to get out. You know, obviously there's also been large booms in the trust and estate industry because of it. And I think it's given people a different, you know, view of life that they might not have had before.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's it is interesting. All those points I get, I understand. You know, if you were like a betting person, it's a risky bet, right?
It is. And I do think it helps that people are getting married later, and that they're experiencing some of the world on their own, kind of coming into themselves and figuring out who they are. Because what I find is happening a lot is that when people have gotten married early, they haven't been able to experience those things. Then you have children.
Yeah.
Most people, right, have children. And then 18 plus years later, your children are gone. And then you're looking at this person. You have no idea who they are. You've more grown apart than grown together. And you get into this rhythm of, you know, you're doing things for your kids. And you're just, you know, on almost like a hamster wheel just to stay afloat. And then it implodes, you know, not necessarily in, you know, a violent or acrimonious way. Just, I don't know who you are. We're not compatible anymore. The kids are, you know, we were so clouded by the kids and trying to keep things going for so many years that, you know, you don't take time to invest in your own relationship.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. I mean, I'm guessing New York metro area, do you have some high profile cases that you work on? And do you ever get involved in like real litigation?
We do have some high profile cases that we have been involved in. And I do think that those cases tend to actually stay out of litigation.
Okay.
Because they first of all, a lot of the higher net worth individuals in higher profile cases, they do have prenuptial agreements. So typically it's about interpreting the terms of the prenuptial agreement. And sure, you get a case or two where people are fighting over the terms and what it means. And I didn't really, he forced me to sign it. I didn't know what I was doing, things like that. But those cases tend to be more in either mediation or in arbitration. So that way they can also remain completely private.
Mm, okay. Can you share like one of your more interesting cases that you worked on?
One was, I had a case where the spouse was potentially going to be facing criminal charges. Ooh. And so it was more of, we need to get divorced quickly before this potentially happens. We need to make sure that the children are safeguarded in case the spouse goes to prison, where the children were going to move, what name the children may or may not assume, depending on how the criminal charges ended up being unveiled, things like that. It was interesting. It all worked out though in the end, but you know, this couple, unfortunately, I don't think would necessarily have gotten divorced, but for what happened. And it was more about, you know, strategy and planning and wanting to make sure that they did what was best in the best interest of the children at the time.
Yeah. This wasn't the Housewives in New Jersey case, was it?
No, it was not. No, no, was not involved in that one.
I know. Just teasing. Is that still on, by the way, that show?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. that whole franchise is going to live on forever.
Really?
Oh yeah. God.
I mean, in the beginning, it was entertaining, particularly in New Jersey. I found very entertaining just because of the personalities and the accents. It was funny to me.
Andy Cohen is a mastermind.
Yeah. Very entertaining for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me just again, just to share with the audience. I mean, so again, what are the sort of the key things you want to share like that would make somebody successful at family law if they were going to choose that area of law?
I think, like I said before, I think being a good listener, you have to be empathetic. And a lot of times the phone calls that I get, they're not necessarily looking for me to have a solution. They're not necessarily looking for me to be able to give them advice. They just need to blow off steam. They need me to understand why they feel the way that they're feeling. And that can be sometimes hard. You're sometimes playing a therapist more than a lawyer on a lot of days. And you need to recognize that not every client is the same. So the way that you interact and speak to one client might not be the best way to interact and speak to another client. So you need to really learn who that client is and who that family is and be able to adjust your approach and adjust how you respond based on that person specifically.
Yeah.
I think a lot of family law, you know, you have to build up a client base. Unlike corporate work, once a client gets divorced, typically you're not going to see them again. So especially it's important to develop a good rapport with your clients because you need referral sources. You need future clients. You need to be able to have a great reputation in whatever kind of niche you want to carve out in this industry. So that way that your clients will also act as your referral sources. Nothing is better than getting a phone call from a new client. And when I ask, oh, how'd you get my name? Them saying the name of a former client. Because at least knows that, you know, that your clients are satisfied with the work that you've done.
Got it. Is this part of the law school curriculum? I mean, do you go in? You don't study this at all, family law?
No.
No.
It's optional. It's an optional elective. But the family law that you study, it's very general. It's not about how to settle a case. It's not about how to divide assets and assets that could be tax affected and not tax affected, yeah, or how certain dollars maybe are worth more at the end of the day than other dollars. It's nothing like that. It's about more about custodial rights of kids, how to measure lifestyle for the purposes of alimony, things that are part of the industry, but not necessarily what you need on a day-to-day basis to be a family law attorney. Got I think it. That's the case though with probably most law school yeah. classes. I hate to say it. Law school should definitely be more practical and definitely have more hands-on component work that's required, because a lot of times you walk out of law school and you could never in your right mind try to file a lawsuit on your own and know exactly what you were doing.
Right. All right. So I'm going to put you're one more person in the column that maybe there should be a year of an apprenticeship or something practical.
There should be. There really, really should yeah. be. And not every law student is going to want the same kind of career, which is also, you know, the practical component of it. You know, I couldn't walk into a prosecutor's office and know what I was doing at this point. So it's, you know, it's, I think we need to get away from the general practitioners. And we have more specialties, just like, you know, the medical field. You wouldn't necessarily go to an optometrist if your ankle was bothering you.
Right.
You can't be, it's really, really hard to be a jack of all trades and be able to honestly say you know how to do it all.
Sure. Your law firm does a lot more, right?
Yeah.
What are the practices? It's a pretty big law firm. How many lawyers?
It is. It is. We have a lot of different practice areas. We have three offices in New Jersey and then one in New York City. We do pretty much almost everything. We have a very large trust and estate practice. We have business services both for litigation and for transactional work. We have real estate. We have a large employment division. We do ERISA and benefits work. We do cybersecurity work. We do commercial lending work. I'm trying to think, I'm going like down the hallway to see who's there. We do, so, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
We have it, which is great for someone in my field because I'm able to get referrals internally, but right. also I'm able to pick up the phone if I have, let's say, a couple who has a small, closely held business, and I can call my partner and say, okay, what documents am I going to need? Is this going to actually work? Is this something that's smart for, you know, the person that I'm representing without having to necessarily go outside my firm? So it's a really, I really enjoy practicing in this kind of firm. I know a lot of people would prefer to say they would practice in a family law only firm, but to me, it's been great. And I've been able to have a wealth of knowledge, you know, at my fingertips.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, so you can service, you know, you can keep it within in-house as opposed to going outside.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And technology, the firm, I mean, how much do you guys leverage technology?
I mean, I live on Zoom right okay. now. So we definitely, Zoom is definitely a huge portion of, I think, everyone's day at this point. You know, we have a very large document management system, so everything is stored electronically now, so we're not as reliant on the red wells and the papers as we used to be. Yep. It's also helped that the court systems have now been much more expansive in terms of what they're accepting electronically before, but I think Zoom has been wonderful for my practice. I think it's something that I think I'm glad that COVID happened and pressed those issues, because it's much easier now for me to have more constant face-to-face communication with my clients. It used to be hard for a lot of clients to take off time from work to come and see me. They'd be running in for, you know, a half an hour on their lunch break. But now it's much easier to say, hey, let's set up a 20-minute Zoom, whether you're in the car or whether you could just, you know, put, you know, go upstairs, put your kid on an iPad for 20 minutes and be able to speak to me. So to me, it's allowed me to have much more, I guess, deeper relationships with the clients, because we're not exchanging emails as much when we can just quickly hop on a Zoom and touch base.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Good. Yeah, no, Zoom is certainly, COVID made that really come alive. And it's funny too, because, you know, video conferencing has been around for a long time, but it's interesting because before COVID, nobody would turn the camera on, right?
So I always have to have my camera on, and my husband is not a lawyer and he never has his camera on. I'll come home and he's wearing, you know, a tank top in December. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I never have to have my camera on. Right. So it depends on the industry. I just think it's weird to be in a room and all you're talking to are these black squares.
Agreed.
It's such a strange thing. I'm not used to it. So it definitely goes to me being a people person and wanting the interaction. So I'm okay with my camera on.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. In fact, a lot of times I'll be in a call and someone won't have it on. I say, oh, I don't know if you realize, but your camera's off.
That's a nice way of passive aggressively saying, please turn your camera on.
Exactly. And many times they don't turn it on. So it doesn't always work. So. All right. Well, just to sort of round it off here, I mean, what do you want to leave with the audience about your firm? Just final thoughts and the best way to connect.
You know, the reason why I came to Lindsbury was because it was comprised of attorneys that when I saw them in court, they were always prepared. They were always professional. And while they were excellent advocates, they also were realistic in terms of the outcomes that were expected. And I think that, you know, I would have no qualms with my mom being represented by anyone at my firm. And I think to me, that's one of the things that I always say, if I give out a referral, I'll always say, you know, I would have no problem sending my mom there, and you should have no problem also speaking to them too. It's a group of individuals who value the work that they do, and they also value each other. And, you know, law is law. And I'm very lucky that I get to practice at least with people that I respect and I get along with. You know, we spend a lot of time in our offices. So I just got lucky with where I ended up. So I think that in terms of, you know, just law and our clients, I think that our firm really does do a great job of advocating, but also at the same time, we are also do a great job of managing the expectations and the outcomes that would be had. And I think it's very easy for any attorney to say whatever they want to say, but at the end of the day, there's only so much that a set of facts can necessarily gain you. In terms of contact, my email address is nkobis, K-O-B as in boy, I-S as in Sam, at lindaberry, LindaBury.com.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, enjoyed it. Learning more about family law, and hopefully I don't have to come visit you.
I hope not either.
For everybody, again, Nicole Kobus, and I'm going to read it again, Lindaberry, McCormick, Estabrook, and Cooper. And this is sponsored by EmotionTrack, which is a legal tech platform that helps litigators prepare for mediation and trials with our Insights platform. Thank you, Nicole. It was a pleasure.
Jonathan, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It was a pleasure, too. Great way to start the week.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.